Maybe the whole idea of a fourth family is still haunted by various ghosts from the past. Let's look at some of these statements. It's already ruled out. So
the particle, when the particle data group is saying something like this for over 10 years, it tends to have a slightly negative impact on a topic. Yeah. there's something unnatural about a heavy force neutrino. Heavy means it has to be at least heavier than half the dead mass. Yeah. Fourth family sheds little light on electroweak symmetry breaking. It sheds little light on the flavor puzzle. I guess if we have three and we can't tell where three comes from, adding a fourth won't add too much. It has no theoretical motivation, and I guess many of the popular models of beyond the standard model physics don't have fourth families. An experimentalist may say, well, we already know how to look for heavy quarks, it's just like cops, so we don't have to do anything for these things. So putting all this together, the fourth family is just plain boring, both theoretically and experimentally. So I have to see who's not. I just wanted to see who was nodding in agreement at this point. Okay, well, a fourth family comes in one of two types, either light or heavy. Light means that the perturbative standard model can still survive, whereas heavy means it can't, and it means there's some new strong interactions that have to show up. Now, CDF has been busy in the last few years in putting these bounds, lower bounds, on these heavy quarks. And so this doesn't leave a lot of room left for the light option. This then raises the question of what exactly is the dividing line between heavy and light. And that's a pretty fuzzy question. I'll say something which maybe suggests it's as low as 400 GeV, or maybe it's closer to 500 GeV. Now, for the light option, I would say that some of those negative statements actually do apply. I think with a light fourth family, we really wouldn't learn that much about either electroweak symmetry breaking or the flavor puzzle. But as you'll see, I'm claiming the heavy option is very different. So let's talk about the light option a little more. So it tries to coexist with the Higgs. But it does affect things, and it does modify the running of the Quartic-Higgs coupling. And there'll be two new terms there due to these large Yukawa couplings. Now, those two terms have to be finely balanced, or else this running coupling will just blow up or go negative at some fairly low scale. The Yukawa couplings themselves are large. They start large, and they'll run quickly, easily into trouble, like another lambda pole or whatever. Now, I'd say, though, that the most troublesome, though, is the direct contribution to the Higgs mass. So this is the usual quadratically divergent loop contribution, which implies there has to be some kind of new physics which cuts this thing off. So that's some new physics that effectively acts like a cutoff. If we assume that cutoff is at least somewhat above the heavy quark masses, then you get this shift in the Higgs mass that goes like this. And if the quark mass is up around 400 GeV, then the Higgs mass is being pushed all the way up to the cutoff. So that's one indication that this dividing line could be as low as 400 GeV.
The contribution
to the electroweak parameter. Yeah, those are constraints. I'll mention those later. Okay. Yeah.
But this is the worst problem
you have in the light. Yeah, this one in particular, I think, is pretty bad. But people have different views of how to think about this thing, this type of effect. And some will tend to just ignore it. Okay, well, a heavy force family just does not coexist with the light beams. And if the heavy force mass is up around 550 GeV, that's close to the unitary upper bound. Now, that bound also is kind of fuzzy, so because it's a bound calculated in perturbation theory, you're trying to figure out when perturbation theory fails by calculating in perturbation theory, and that's kind of fuzzy. So, yeah, anywhere around that range, you're getting close to this bound, though, and then you know for sure that the Goldstone bosons will couple strongly to these heavy quarks. And then you know for sure that strong interaction for unitary double-double scattering. So not only is the Higgs losing meaning, but it's also no longer needed because these strong interactions can clearly be responsible for breaking the symmetry and responsible for these Goldstone bosons. So if that's the case, then we shouldn't be talking about a Higgs bev anymore. We should be talking about a Fermi-Higgs condensate. Okay, now, as you see, the
whole picture is starting to change. So I have to say a few words about what's going on. If there's no Higgs, there are no Yukawa couples. So then where do you get masses from? So if instead of a Higgs bev, we're talking about a heavy fermion bev. Then what we do need then are four fermion operators. So these are going to replace the Yukawa coupling. And that implies there's some new scale, flavor scale. And the scale can be up around a few hundred to a thousand GeV. Sorry, what is? These are the heavy fermions, and they will be the fourth family. Yeah. All of the family will have these kind of effects. But there's nothing
to do with technique. So anyway, you see that in the presence of this condensate, then this does act the same way as the Yukawa coupling term does, and it
implies masses for lighter things suppressed by that kind of ratio. Okay, well, there's nothing new here. These kind of ideas were being discussed when I was a student. Okay, and as you're asking, what is causing this thing? Well, something strong. So it's either strong unbroken gauge interaction or broken gauge interaction. So I'm not talking about the unbroken case. That's technical. I'm talking about the broken case. So a broken gauge interaction can give rise to effective four fermion interaction, and that's getting us similar to the old NGL model, which is really ancient history. This predates the Higgs.
Now, which ones don't? Is it
all of the four family ones?
Including the colored ones? I mean, it must be, because if you take all possible bilinears of fermions, I'm going to get all kinds of things I don't want to break, right? So what's your rule for which ones?
Well, there's only so many mass terms. I guess there's a mass matrix.
But your rule is it color singlet and electromagnetics neutral, and then get with that everything?
Yeah, the unbroken things and the electroweakness is broken.
Yeah.
So these are just standard like terms, just like in QCD. So QCD does exactly the same thing. It would break electroweak.
Yeah. Traditionally, we have problems doing strong interaction physics. So how do you prove unitarity in the TUV?
In the same way you worry about that in QCD.
QCD is a problem.
It's not a problem. QCD is unitary. It's a real theory.
So I guess the spirit of the question, though, is are you going to tell us the QCD part, or are we going to work phenomenologically with bilinears?
Well, let me just continue and see how far I go. So, yeah, it's this broken case I have to talk about because, by definition, the fourth family is not coupled to some new unbroken gauge interaction. So I mentioned the NGL model. So this is the NGL model. Some new forcing operators which are strong enough to actually cause these things to condense. And so combined with these flavor, these Porfirion operators generated at a higher scale, these generated at a low enough scale to be strong enough to generate the mass, you can then see that all these things can be put together and arise from some kind of broken flavor interaction. So flavor gauge interaction is broken at this higher scale, up to, say, 1,000 TeV, but some remnant remains unbroken. And that remnant survives down to closer to a TeV scale, and finally it breaks too. So that's just an overall outline.
That's just an overview of the whole picture. And of course, there's all kinds of model building questions that we could get into, but let me just proceed.
Let's see. I mean, so that's the picture. Yeah, theorists like to argue about things like this, but it's something to consider, and it leads to this question, because as I said, the heavy option for family is not compatible with the light Higgs. And as we're also going to see, a heavy family is not that hard to see at the RC. So it leads to this question, is it possible that by finding a heavy fourth family at the LHC quite early, will that actually rule out the Higgs before we actually seriously look for it? So that's something worth thinking about. But there's one hurdle we have to get over before doing that, is being able to tell a sequential quark from a vector-like quark. Now, vector-like quarks are fairly popular, even though they're quite ugly. And by definition, a vector-like quark can have a mass that doesn't break any chiral symmetries. So their masses have nothing to do with electroweak symmetry breakage. They're completely unconstrained. And they arise in all kinds of models with light Higgs, heavy Higgs, or no Higgs. But for us, the question is, how can we tell them apart? And the main point is that they do have these non-standard decays, especially involving Z. So a little later, I'll get back to trying to answer this question, how do we tell it apart from the sequential part? Well, here's an earlier question asked, how will the sequential part family first start to show? So I'll just assume these standard decay modes are these T prime and D prime. And I'll make no use of B tagging, and that's only because when I was doing this, I had no idea that the B tagging was going to work so fast. So with B tagging, life is going to be a lot easier. So the early warning systems that have been discussed, one is same sign leptons. And that comes from the B prime production. All these W's, so you're going to get some same sign leptons. And the backgrounds are small, so that's good, but the branch interactions are also small. So that's not so good. And the other thing is the same sign leptons can also be a sign of other mutants. Now I'm going to spend some time looking at the excess of boosted and isolated W's. And that these things arise in both D prime and T prime. So when a W is boosted, then the two quarks coming out are close together, those two jets actually turn into one jet. And those are called W jets. And I'll just show some plots here where I'm just looking for a peak in the jet from very fast. So here are the details for what I use to simulate. I won't go through any details except I am using PGS, of course, so the experimentalists can have their chuckles with that. I'm not using it for anything very complicated, but not even detailing, so maybe it's not so bad. So here's the search. One of the main things is using a cone size quite large to capture those W jets. I also put on an HT cutter on twice the mass of Hickey Park. Of course, you don't know the Hickey Park mass ahead of time, but if you start to see a signal, you can just adjust, optimize HT.
Are you using a cone algorithm?
I was using an anti-KT. So three more jets that are strong and a lepton. So in each event, then, all I do is find the jet with the largest invariant mass, and if it's isolated, keep it and use it to form a histogram. So I just want to show you some of these histograms. So here's the signal only for those parameters. And I show the combined signal, and the yellow is just the T prime by itself. So that's a nice peak. So what's the background? Well, the background is larger, but it doesn't have a strong peak at the W mass. And that's because the Ws that come out of the tops are usually not isolated. And this W here has to go into the lepton. So you see, if you have a B tag, then the W plus jet background will go down a lot. Now, putting the two together, you see some kind of structure around W mass. So let's reduce the root S. Same shape peak, but this is where you see how big the signal is, and it's getting tiny. Background, again, no, it's smooth. But again, I guess these kind of numbers are too small. Okay, well, that's 600 GeV. Let's reduce 600 to 450. Now the signal goes up again. And now there's some garbage down here.
So what is your vertical axis?
Just numbers.
Full number, right?
Yep. Numbers in each bin here.
Yeah, there's some garbage down here because for a smaller quark mass, the W's are not being boosted as much. You just get some junk down there.
Second one goes up only as a half.
That's true. Yeah, these are just normalized to the luminosity that I've got here. So I generate lots of events and then just normalize the whole thing down.
And a different binning.
And the binning is changing too?
Pardon me?
Sorry?
And a different binning between the two.
In between the two colors?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Oh, no, well, no, I think it's just the thick lines are.
I think they're the same.
They should be the same. Okay, the background again, no. A large structure on the W mass.
So if you see any kind of structure in a jet mass plot, it could become interesting.
Yeah, I do have some kind of cut.
The jets that I'm actually plotting here are just the ones with the largest jet mass. I don't worry about what you hear.
Probably trim that all out of the data. We won't be able to look. Well, depending on exactly how you get down there,
no,
we
no,
probably
no.
Won't be able to get down there.
No, I don't care about the jet.
Sure.
So this, when you say jet mass, this is actually the mass of the reconstructed single jet.
No, I understand there's a non-trivial relationship between the jet ET and the jet mass.
Okay, so if these W jets are
an interesting way to identify Ws, then can they be used to help reconstruct the heavy quark mass itself? and it, this is easier for the T prime. So the T prime, you just got the two strong V jets and the W jets. So if we just look for events with three hard jets, and one of them looks like it could be a W jet, then there's just two ways to pair up the W with one of those other jets to hopefully reconstruct the heavy core. Now, let me not worry about trying to choose the best one. I'll just choose both and put them both on a histogram. So I'm, again, being very simple-minded here. And even being very simple-minded, you do get some kind of structure around the reconstructed mass, if you hope to see.
A priori? Because then there are six combinations if you don't get that one.
Well, I do say here, if there is more than one W, for example, then there will be more than two combinations. No.
The 5Bs and so on would actually be very similar to the QCD background that one estimates for high PT talks. Okay. And though you haven't actually included in this.
No, that's your problem.
Well, it kind of really screws up the jet, taking the most massive jet. Because the background, now you have lots of jets, and the background is actually a factor of 100 or so, at least, bigger than TT bar.
Yeah, but I do have this isolated lepton, which helps to reduce.
But also, you're not requiring T-type, right? So, you're already including the TC backgrounds, right?
Including.
Or not the W, to the lepton.
I'm talking about the QCD background just coming from pure QCD multi-jet production.
Giving rise to, so it's the fake lepton, or the lepton.
You have a fake lepton, yeah. You get the whole megillah from the QCD. You know, fake lepton, missing ET, you mismeasure the jet, and away you go.
Yeah. Yeah, but this sort of requirement of a lepton is usually the only thing you have a handle on, right, to kill that background, and to kill it in one process, and kill it in another. I agree, it has to be checked, but of course I can't model QCD backgrounds.
Sure you can. You can attempt to.
But here it is not detailing.
Okay. So again, you just keep looking at these numbers. These are the numbers in each bin. And because of this very simple-minded way of just pairing up everything in all possible ways, I'm avoiding any kind of fake peak that sometimes arises in the background plots when you actually try to reconstruct everything properly. So, if I reduce 7 TV, the sigma goes way down. And dropping to 450, the sigma goes back up. And so I don't know. Does that look promising?
Well, are you
yeah.
stacking them on top of each other? So the background and sigma are just stacked.
Yeah, they're stacked. Anyway, whether it's promising or not, it's enough to suggest that a heavy four family is not going to be that hard to show. I'm just a very simple-minded theorist, and you guys are very sophisticated. And so whatever I do will be much better when you do it.
Well, the studies on TT bar, and there's been a lot. The it's still a challenge if you're looking at the unresolved component, right, which you're looking at that in part. And the I would worry about the biggest thing that you haven't actually tackled is probably the one that is the most difficult, which is the QCD action.
But why do you think it would be more of a problem in this type of analysis?
No, it's just a huge problem in the TT-bar case, especially at this PT. At the QCD background, it's very high. And, you're doing the partially, what we would characterize as partially resolved final state, where you have a lepton on one side and missing a teeth. So that helps. So you're the number of games.
How about this thing that you change that lepton?
I'll get back to you. Okay, so more recently, I've gone to the other extreme. And this is work with Xi Xinyan, who was a former postdoc, now he's back in Beijing. And so we went wild. with neural networks, you can go wild. And we have 40 variables.
Wait a second, I thought you said you were just a naive theorist.
He's a wild and crazy naive.
Yeah, so this is a huge black box, and I'm even one step removed because I didn't run the neural network.
They use neural networks in financial markets.
So with a huge black box, you can't do anything with it except look at the final result. And so I would take these numbers with a grain of salt. But there are three scenarios on this plot. And these scenarios have to do with how you treat, how you train. But in the training, how do you treat the V prime when you're looking for the T prime? So in scenario one, we tell the neural network to treat the V prime as background. So it makes an effort to try to distinguish these two signals. And that gives you the lower curve. Scenario two, we just tell the neural network, we don't tell it anything about the V prime. And so when you actually use the neural network and a V prime event ends up looking like it, and a V prime event ends up looking like a T prime event, the neural network is allowed to keep it. And that gives you a one up. And then in scenario three, we actually train the neural network to treat the V prime as signal. And that's a little odd because the reconstruction we're doing is geared for the T prime. And, well, okay, so this is showing the power of the neural network because it's saying that, okay, I'm looking for these things, and even though the reconstruction we do is producing something that doesn't look like a T prime, but it also doesn't look like background. And the neural network is strong enough to say that it's not background. And that gives you the best result.
Whose mass is across the bottom?
That's the heavy quark mass. Now I think, okay, so we also looked at the Pevitron set of parameters to do the same thing. And it's even more dramatic there, that if you start training the neural network in these different ways, you get a much larger spot, a larger range in the sensitivities. On the other hand, like I mentioned, the CDF mass limits, they treat the search for putting the limit on those two quark masses, T prime and D prime, as completely separate analysis. So what I think this is saying, that if they were actually serious on setting a limit on the mass of a real fourth family doublet, they could do better. Because when they look for the T prime, they just ignore the existence of the D prime. It's not considered. But clearly, if you have both of them, if you're assuming that they both exist, then I think you could do a better job of setting a limit on that.
There's some assumption on the mass difference between T prime and D prime.
In my case, I always assume they're the same.
Yeah.
But in their case, they don't have, they assume it's infinite mass for the D prime.
Do you have a reason for assuming that it's it?
Well, that's part of the electrical constraints on these models. They should be close to being the same.
Do you know how far that
is? M to GV,
so these models are almost degenerate.
Close.
Yeah.
50 GV has been discussed. In fact, yeah, we'll see a little more later.
Okay, well, let's get back to one of these other questions. How to tell a vector-like quark from these sequential quarks? So let's consider a doublet of these vector quarks, big D, T, and big D. Now, they couple in and mix with the normal top and bottom through Yukawa coupling. And since this phi here can be either, well, it can be the kid, but it can also be the Goldstone boson, which means that these couplings induce decay modes involving W and Z. So that's where the Z decay mode comes from. And because it comes that way, you actually know how big it is. I've color-coded these branching modes. And you can see the way the colors appear, that it doesn't really matter the ratio of those two lines, that the proportions of these three things are going to stay the same. And it turns out the number of Zs produces roughly 1/4. And that's true for other kinds of vector-like quarks as well. So that's the handle we have, is to look for these Zs, which go into leptons. And so I'll just call these leptons that come from Z, I'll just call them Z leptons. And now we can come back to the same sign lepton. And let's just compare these two. Now, both of these have rather small backgrounds if you use the right event selection. I won't go through the details. But basically, the backgrounds are small enough that these are just counting experiments. And let me consider the highest mass case. These numbers go up, of course, if the mass is lower. Okay, so for a sequential quark, you're going to see the same sign leptons. Again, this is from the B prime going into all those W's. Whereas you don't see any much in the way of PZ leptons. For vector-like quarks, you can have a possible range of the same sign leptons, and that range has to do with the ratio of those two Yukawa couplings. On the other hand, from what I just said, we know we should see PZ leptons. And here's an estimate of the background of those Z leptons. Okay, so if we start seeing a fourth family, and then we start seeing these same sign leptons, if it's the case that we're not seeing as many or more of these Z leptons, then I think that's starting to be evidence that you're looking for a fourth family. Okay, now I want to go more, the rest will be more on the theory side of things, and let's go back to one of these negative statements about neutrinos. Why is the neutrino so different for the fourth family? And does that mean it's a Dirac mass? So that is a bias that exists, that a heavy neutrino mass is usually taken to be Dirac. But I would answer that question to be no. You need a right-handed neutrino to have a Dirac mass, but I would say there's no reason for right-handed neutrinos to exist at the TV scale. I've already mentioned the higher scale of flavor. There may be interactions there that are giving rise to these right-handed neutrino masses. And And so we've been, you were talking about where do these masses come from? Well, this new strong interaction couples to all members of a family, whatever it is. So they're all equally likely to form a mass. And so the neutrino is no different. And I guess, as you said, the real question is why the other ones are so light. Okay, so I'm introducing the idea that the fourth neutrino is a minor on the mass neutrino. And before getting to this thing, let's look at an advantage of a minor on a mass neutrino.
Repeats of six. That's all. Sorry. We should expect a heavy electron, heavy neutron, heavy tone. So you have to see a heavy electron.
I call that a tau prime.
Ah.
Yeah. You have to see all these things. Except the LHC is likely that the quarks will show up first.
Is the picture that you're gauging SU4 or something which rotates the generations? Or?
That could be the picture at the high scale. At the TEV scale, there's just a remnant of that left that is enough to give the fourth family a mass. Okay, now we can talk about these electrical constraints, S and T.
And I just want to show you what happens due to the Majorana nature of that mass. You get these two negative contributions to F and T. Now I want to show on this plot why that tends to help. Okay, so what I'm doing here are plotting these S and T contributions as a function of the tau prime mass. This negative contribution pushes down the green curve. On the other hand, we need a positive T contribution because we have no more light Higgs. The whole reason for having a light Higgs is to produce a positive T, although it's usually not said that way. But that's what a light Higgs does. If you take it away, you need something else to produce a positive T. And any fermion doublet with a mass splitting produces a positive T. So, in fact, these various doublets cannot be completely degenerate, or at least it helps if they're not completely degenerate. Okay, so the green curve is going down. We have to be pushed to the right to get a positive T, which could be as high as 0.5. And then you see that's good because the S from the leptons is becoming more negative due to this mass splitting, and that helps to cancel the positive contribution from the quarks. So one reason I'm bringing this up, because there have been quite a few recent analyses on S and T constraints on a fourth family, but they don't consider this possibility. So those studies are not as general as they claim they are. Then those terms go away, and this effect that I just described doesn't occur. But that's what is discussed in the literature. But it's still a claim that the fourth family is still alive. This just makes it easier for the fourth family. Am I running out of time?
Yeah. Much time.
Yeah. Okay, I'll just flash things. People can guess what I'm talking about.
You know, little one.
Yes, it's now starting.
You wanted to know why neutrinos are light. Well, there it is.
I mean, here's a four fermion operator that feeds down a mass from the tau prime to the electron. You can't do the same thing for the left-handed neutrino. You have to use a six fermion operator, but that's enough. So using these values, you get masses in the right range.
So engage group and you break everything. It's just you're writing down all possible higher dimensional operators involving fermions. That's kind of the rules are that you can, you only turn on devs that are singlets and.
Yeah, I like it when I see something like this where things seem to work out without putting in new scales. But the deep questions of what is the dynamics and all that stuff is still to be worked out or found.
You can write down, you do write down with order one coefficients and you just see what you get.
The standard seesaw is quite different, as you know. There, the right hand neutrino is way up a very high scale, and that introduces a hierarchy problem. And so, along the lines of just saying, some operators you like to have suppressed, and that implies there should be some kind of approximate symmetries in the game. So, of the type fourth family something minus third family something. In the quark sector, such an approximate symmetry means that the top mass operator is this one, and that seems to have some advantage as well. Actually, this is a very old tension in any kind of dynamical symmetry breaking model to deal with that problem. But I'm really bringing this up because this approximate symmetry could in fact be corresponding to this remnant flavor gauge symmetry that I mentioned. So there's a real gauge boson involved here. There's some PD mass gauge boson. It couples strongly also to the third family. When it gets produced at the LHC, it decays into BD bar, BD bar, tau plus tau minus.
Okay, so I'm finishing. Hopefully I've overcome some of those negative statements at the beginning. And I think everyone agrees that the fourth family is not going to be that hard to find. If it is found, it has, I think, deep implications, especially if it's of the strong variety. And the main thing it does is overthrow a dynasty. The era of the Higgs comes to an end. And then, of course, the whole focus of the LHC will suddenly shift. And I think the focus of theorists will also shift, because we would be seeing that new strong dynamics are showing up exactly where they're needed, and this would be a serious blow to finely tuned theories and anthropic ideas. Okay, thank you.